Welcome, everybody. Glad to see a full house. Just for my own knowledge, how many people in this room are either teachers, administrators, or others? So teachers first. Teachers. Awesome. Administrators? And other? Awesome. Great. Great. A nice mix. That's terrific. So who am I? My name is Peter Nielsen. I'm an English teacher, and I'm assistant academic dean at Deerfield Academy, which is an independent school in Massachusetts. I've been there for 8 years. That was interrupted by 4 years in which I moved to New York City to be a musician. I was also a political organizer and a writer and a bunch of other things, but I missed education, and so I went back to grad school and then came back to the school that I had been at before in both a teaching and administrative role. Have a lot to get through today, which will be built around 5 questions. How do we teach creativity? What exactly is creativity? What is the relationship between creativity and critical thinking? How do we assess creativity? And where does this fit in our already busy lives? To go about this or to do this, go through the plan is to have 5 sections. One is to begin with a short argument asserting the relationship between and the importance of both critical thinking and creativity together. 2, to clarify a few definitions and distinctions so that we know what we're talking about. And these two together will take about 10 minutes or so, 10 or 15 minutes. Then to introduce 2 new theories, 3 regions of creativity, which is where creativity happens, and a taxonomy of creative design, or how to teach creativity. From there, we'll look at a little bit of these theories in practice. And these two together, so that's how to teach creativity well and how to assess creativity. And these two together will take about the middle 30 minutes or so. And then to wrap up with some closing thoughts, hopefully with some time for questions and discussions at the end. It's a lot to get through in an hour, so I'll aim to move briskly and stick to just the meaty stuff. So, to begin, a short argument. I think when we talk about creativity, we have to talk about critical thinking, because I think the skills are like yin and yang. They're complementary opposites. And so here is a concise argument for why we need both critical thinking skills and creativity. Part of what motivates many of us as educators is understanding that the world our students are entering is more complex and more demanding of our attention than it ever has been. In our civic responsibilities, for example, we're reminded of the necessity of sound critical thinking skills for a functioning society. At elections, at the ballot box, we make decisions about complex issues like tax policy, international relations, campaign finance reform, and much, much more. And today, in this day and age, whether or not campaign commercials are based on any kind of rational fact. You know, things we have to address. In courts, we measure and evaluate the intricacies of DNA evidence, of financial systems, of statistical analyses. Navigating these turbulent waters of civic life today challenges our critical thinking skills more and more as we sift, as we sort through, as we engage, evaluate, and prioritize the rising tide of information. But if our critical thinking skills are what allow us to understand the world around us, our creative skills are what enable us to respond to it, to develop equally novel solutions to the novelty of our challenges. On a large scale, how do we renovate urban and suburban infrastructure as population grows to unprecedented levels? How do we refine our food supplies and harness new energy sources to match this unprecedented growth? Or more personally, more intimately, and more relevant to what we all do on a day-to-day basis, how do we raise children when they can access the world's information and even the world's population increasingly from their desktops and even from their pockets? These new challenges require not only that we critically understand the challenges around us, but that we can create new solutions to address and resolve them. And so as our personal lives and national and global lives grow increasingly more busy and complex, we need greater creative skills to survive and thrive. Here's a visualization of this argument. Last year at South by Southwest Interactive, one speaker described the relationship between engineers and designers in the tech space in a way that best describes, I believe, the relationship between critical thinking and creativity. These are from his slides, but slightly altered. Given an existing paradigm represented by the short hill on this image, and given placement within this paradigm as designated by the red dot, the speaker argued that the analytics provided by engineers enable teams to maximize effectiveness within their given paradigm. This is the power of critical thinking. This is the power of analysis. But designers are the ones who will develop alternate paradigms that provide potentially superior solutions to program requirements, which engineers can then further refine. This is the power of creativity, to open up new solutions, new ways of seeing and doing what it is that we see and do. As a result, creativity is showing up everywhere in the marketplace of ideas. The Department of Education has opened up an Office of Innovation and Improvement. Private companies built around engineering, innovation engineering, like Eureka Ranch and IDEO, are growing in size and number. Arts organizations that specialize in generating and catalyzing original work, such as the dance troupe Pilobolis, are now working with corporations to promote creative thinking in the business sector, for better or for worse. And 21st century skills, which we've heard a lot about, includes learning and innovation skills at the top of its framework. And among those are the four C's, including creativity and critical thinking. And creativity is becoming so important that innovative was the second most used term on LinkedIn profiles. And this presents some new challenges, as reported by America's Finest News Source. Gotta love the Onion. So creativity is everywhere in demand. And so with all this on the landscape, to prepare our students for both engaged citizenship and for gainful employment, we need to be deliberate about teaching both critical thinking and creativity. So we should start by sorting through a number of terms. How does innovation differ from creativity? What do we mean when we say critical thinking? And what about everything we've heard about divergent and convergent thinking? How are these different? How does this all work together? How does it interrelate? These are important distinctions if we're to meaningfully understand the subject. So where to start? Critical thinking is most familiarly definable to us because it offers a template for understanding the others, and it's most useful because it offers a template for understanding the others. Most educators are familiar with models like Bloom's taxonomy of educational objectives. Education at its base, according to Bloom, is merely the transfer of knowledge. Our goals take us up the taxonomy, challenging our students' comprehension of topics, their application of knowledge, and so on, until we reach the one end of education, which was evaluation. This offers a clear framework for scaffolding and organizing critical thinking. When we develop our classwork, whether we think about Bloom or not, we generally aim for upwards movement through the various objectives. But Bloom's taxonomy has been revised over the years. Anderson and Kratwal offered a variation in 2001, changing nouns for verbs mostly, but also cutting synthesis and adding create at the top, which is a sign of our times. 5 years later, Marzano and Kendall compressed Bloom further and added several metacognitive levels to the taxonomy, acknowledging, or arguing anyway, that education more broadly means not only instilling critical thinking skills, but also the internalization of motivation, of process awareness, and of information application, and also the ability to monitor our own thinking and performance. During this time, the Program for International Student Assessment, PISA, quietly began offering an assessment framework with its own taxonomy. All but one of the words they use are new, but the concepts are similar to the other versions, as the colors here show. What we gather from this evolution of educational objectives is, first, that apparently we're only allowed 6 objectives. But second, while our articulation of them varies slightly, there's significant agreement and overlap. This is wonderfully helpful as we seek to develop challenging and rigorous material that hones our students' critical thinking. Understanding and developing creativity in our students is far more complicated. And so as governments, schools, businesses, and conference speakers describe the urgent need for creative and innovative people, we as teachers and schools charged with producing more creative students are left with little concrete guidance for how to accomplish this urgent and necessary feat. We celebrate it when we see it, and we say, yes, more of that. But we have few, if any, ways to apply these methods more strategically, more systematically, through the curriculum. Solutions appear to be everywhere. The arts increase creativity. More sleep induces the synthesis that precedes creativity. Ignoring feedback is the key to creating something new. Word association games conjure new thoughts. Open-ended assignments stimulate creativity. Design thinking is surely a way. And game design, which seems to be the current panacea, seems to be a must. And there's much, much more. Inevitably, all of these do encourage creative behavior. But again, there has not yet existed a way to unify what we know about creativity the way Bloom's and the other taxonomies organize what we know about critical thinking. The language of divergent, some of the definitions here, the language of divergent and convergent thinking has been in vogue recently too. However, and this is a really good place to start. Led by the trumpet of Ken Robinson and others, divergent thinking in particular has become almost synonymous with creativity. Let's look briefly at what this means, what these terms mean. In convergent thinking, we begin with information and we converge around a solution. Broadly, this is a good model for how critical thinking works. Divergent thinking, on the other hand, starts with a prompt, and we diverge out to many solutions. To many, this has become synonymous with creativity. But the most meaningful creativity comes when we mix convergent and divergent thinking, when we test our creative solutions critically. This is how we test the value of our novelty. The novelty is in the divergence. The convergence is what identifies value. And this helps us understand innovation, because definitions of innovation abound. Innovation is what happens when creativity has a bottom line. Innovation is the conversion of knowledge or ideas into a benefit. Innovation is invention plus exploitation. It's the process that transforms ideas into commercial value. People creating value by implementing new ideas, a new method, idea, or product, a new product, process, or service that is discontinuous from prior practice and yields new avenues for solving problems and fulfilling an organization's mission. Okay. And a change that produces more than marginally better results. These are all great. They're numerous. But we can see in these definitions common elements. We see novelty, and this sounds a lot like divergence, like newness, like creativity. And we see evaluation, we see improving outcomes, and this, and measuring this is a critical thinking challenge. And so we understand innovation to be novelty that creates value or novelty that improves outcomes. Successful innovation is a blend of critical thinking and creativity. These are helpful definitions. But in this sea of definitions, we are still adrift, left without a clear route to land, a clear framework to help guide teachers as we try to promote, as we try to scaffold creativity the way we can scaffold other skills. And this leads to the main questions for today. What is creativity? Where and how does it happen? And how do I teach it? In an effort to fill that vacuum, my goal for the rest of today is to organize and present my understanding of where and how creativity happens. There are two ways to understand creativity. First, the three regions of for creativity, where creativity happens. And second, in the spirit of Bloom, a taxonomy of creative design. These are works in progress, and I offer them here as an effort to collect and organize two parts of what we do, teaching critical thinking and teaching creativity, which together are the source of innovation, in a way that may be useful to all of us as educators. So, where does creativity live? My sense is that creativity happens in places that are defined by the nature of perception. Objects and behaviors exist in the world. We perceive them through our senses, and we hold representations of them in our minds. This opens up three conceptual spaces for creativity. The material space, which is the object or behavior itself and the form it takes. The modal space, the mode of perception, which is the sense or senses through which we perceive the work, the moderator between the world and our thoughts. And the mind, which is the intellectual framework within which we understand the work. Creative work, then, can be done materially, which means creating or altering physical behavior or materials, can be done modally, which means translating a work through different modes of perception, or it can be done mentally by reframing the way we understand a pre-existing work. And here's a closer look at each. Material creativity is what we most often think of when we think of creativity. These are either objects or behaviors of people or objects. They are creations that exist either in physical form, like a painting, an automobile, an iPhone, an essay, or a book, or they exist in behaviors, like the game of soccer, like a postal route, a meeting agenda, or a vacation itinerary. Material creativity is made up of stuff we create out of stuff or out of actions. In this way, a governmental structure, a course syllabus, or any organized social setting, a conference, is a material creative work. In this light, it's no stretch of the imagination. It's no stretch to see the entire development and growth of a civilization as a great work of material creativity, a collection of novel objects and behaviors. Modal creativity is the act of translating the sensory experience of an object or behavior from one mode of perception to another. Consider the story of the Nutcracker. It began as a verbal experience, the German story, The Nutcracker and the Mouse King, by E.T.A. Hoffman. Before Tchaikovsky, the Russian choreographer, Marius Petipa, envisioned it as a ballet before there was any music. And in so doing, he made a modal shift from a verbal form to a visual form. His creation is, for all purposes, the same thing, the same story, but modally shifted into a wordless visuospatial representation. Then, he, the choreographer, gave very specific instructions to Tchaikovsky to translate the story into a musical auditory experience, straight down to the tempo and length of parts of pieces, which was the second modal shift. Again, it was the same work, but it was now an auditory experience. The creative efforts that made the Nutcracker involved movement through separate modes of perception, as each version tells the same story, but one is visual, one is auditory, one is verbal, rather, one is visual, and one is auditory. This is modal creativity. And the final region of creativity is mental creativity. Mental creativity is the development of new ways of thinking about a subject or object. It does not change the material substance or the modal perception. It only changes how we think about the subject or object, how we hold it in our minds. For instance, William Blake on John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost, a long epic poem that expands a story from Genesis. What William Blake wrote of John Milton that he was of the devil's party without knowing it. Blake sought to change the intellectual lens through which readers read Paradise Lost. He did not change the work or the mode through which we perceive it. He sought to change how we understand it, our mindset about it. He framed it not as a devotional text, but as a subversive text. This kind of creativity is one we see most often, I think, in the legal and in the political worlds, as litigators and politicians attempt to reframe an issue in an intellectual landscape aligned with their argument or affiliation. And our students do it too, and they've done something wrong. They see it in a very different way than we do, even though it's the same action. Again, this region of creativity exists not in the work itself, nor in our experience consuming the work, but in how we understand the work. And so what does this mean for schools and for teachers? We have three regions of creativity, the material, the modal, and the mental, and we see evidence of it in different disciplines. And we have opportunities to encourage our students and ourselves to further explore creativity in all three regions. As teachers, I think we see material creativity the most. It's what we encourage the most. We ask our students to create works in many forms, the homework they do every day, the activities in class, and the assessments we provide. I'll speak more about this in a minute. I've begun to wonder, though, if material creativity is creativity in objects or behaviors, what new behaviors can we encourage? Surely there are plenty of opportunities for creative work, but creative behavior, and what place does that have in our classrooms? Enacted scenes from plays might be a good start. Surely there's room for more. In other disciplines, mock trials and debates, student-designed labs, dialogues in foreign languages, these take up the charge. There must be many more ways for us to explore material creativity. Modally, we might encourage students to use alternate modes to perform their analytical work. Take Shakespeare's Othello. At the end of Act One, we might use a social graph to reveal character dynamics as well as any written analysis. What are the lines of trust? What are the lines of hate? What are the lines of deception? How does the graph reveal chains of trust, objects of hatred, and the risks of deception? Even if you have not read or seen the play, through this clear visual analysis, you can understand who has power through trust, who is the receptacle of ire, and who risks exposure. This visual analysis is more efficient and effective than a lengthier verbal one. Another terrific example of the effectiveness of creative work that changes modes is the RSA animation of Ken Robinson's speech about changing educational paradigms. How many people have seen that? Okay, about 40% of the room, maybe. I'll show just about a minute of it. Here's a brief 1 minute excerpt.
Every country on earth at the moment is reforming public education. There are two reasons for it. The first of them is economic. People are trying to work out how do we educate our children to take their place in the economies of the 21st century. How do we do that? Given that we can't anticipate what the economy will look like at the end of next week, as the recent turmoil is demonstrating. How do we do that? The second, though, is cultural. Every country on earth is trying to figure out how do we educate our children so they have a sense of cultural identity and so that we can pass on the cultural genes of our communities while being part of the process of globalization. How do we square that circle? The problem is they're trying to meet the future by doing what they did in the past. And on the way, they're alienating millions of kids who don't see any purpose in going to school. When we went to school, we were kept there with a story, which is if you worked hard and did well and got a college degree, you would have a job. Our kids don't believe that. And they're right not to, by the way. You're better having a degree than not, but it's not a guarantee anymore. And particularly not if the route to it marginalizes most of the things that you think are important about yourself.
All right, so animators here add a visual representation of Robinson's speech to an audio recording of it. And the effect compels attention and understanding in really effective ways. Last year at South by Southwest Interactive, artists created improvised versions of these videos, and you increasingly see these now at conferences. Lastly, anyone interested in fostering modal creativity really ought to take a look at the work of Edward Tufte, who's dedicated a lifetime to visualization of information. Really terrific stuff. And so the last category, mental creativity. We see mental creativity across our curriculum, for we have eons of records of its existence in the past. This is in our history classes. Teaching history, as I understand it, is much more about teaching the way we understand events than it is about teaching the action of the events, what happened during the events. In the sciences as well, it seems our courses focus less on the facts that we observe, which may be the starting point, and much more on the conceptual frameworks that describe or explain these observations. For our students, these are, when we're at our best, moments of discovery which require a kind of mental creativity to construct this new worldview. I often wonder, though, how often we as teachers have the opportunity to experience the same kind of revelation in which the lens through which we see something changes. Here's one such moment I had recently as an example. I'm sure just about everybody in this room has heard about the gamification of education. If you haven't, here's another chance. Last year at South by Southwest Interactive again, 22-year-old Seth Prebosch, who dropped out from Princeton University to found a website called Scavenger, shared that it is his intention to build a game layer on top of the world. His goal is to take the lessons learned from the game design industry, which grew larger than Hollywood in 2004, and apply them to other elements of the world. His talk began with schools, which he described as the perfect game ecosystem. Schools involve motivated players, challenges, rewards, rules, levels, appointment dynamics, countdowns, incentives, disincentives, all part of game design. But he argues that schools are crippled by a number of structural hazards. One of his examples is the role of grades. Grades in gameplay are like levels. In cum laude, percentile markings and the honor roll are statuses or badges that students can earn based on their levels. Currently, however, students can lose in this game. Their grades can go down. In the language of gameplay, he argues that students should never be able to level down by dropping from an A to a C, for example, because this offers a disincentive to continue engaging. In video games today, players rarely face the disincentive of losing. And as the Gates Foundation pointed out yesterday, 97% of kids play video games today. How do they rarely face this disincentive of losing? Games accomplish this by using progression dynamics instead of weighted averages. In games, players earn points for what they accomplish. They earn points for what they accomplish instead of losing points for their mistakes, as students do on assessments. In games, a player who does not succeed has the chance to try again. Applying this to a class would mean that students gain, let's say, the quadratic formula leveler badge after successfully using the quadratic formula in the way a teacher determines. If they do not succeed, they can practice and try again. Once they do so to the teacher's satisfaction, they move on to the completing the square level. And after several more levels, they might have to complete the review level for factoring polynomials. To me, this is a compelling reframing of how a school might operate. Is school a game? Certainly not, at least not in the way that we see games as being frivolous. But envisioning education systems as a game ecosystem in this way offers opportunities for development and growth. Followers of the talks on TED.com will be well familiar with this by now, and Khan Academy's use of progression dynamics in its back-end software, not the front-end videos, but in the back-end tracking of student progress, may be familiar to many as well. All of this involves a dramatic reimagining of how we understand schools, a reimagining that requires first the mental creativity to see the new vision of education in one's mind, and then the material creativity to make it a practical reality. So, recognizing these three regions for creativity, material, modal, and mental, there are several ways in which we might reimagine our teaching. What other material approaches might we take with our students? How might we stimulate modal creativity? What novel perspectives can we bring to the content of our coursework, to the very infrastructure of our classes? These are the regions or spaces that house our creative work, but the question, of course, still remains, how do I teach it? How do I teach creativity? How can I understand creativity as a progression, just as I can understand a progression of critical thinking? There are plenty of suggestions, again, as I mentioned before, but they are as diverse and diffuse as our students' attention on the first warm day of spring, or perhaps our own attention midweek, mid-morning, on hump day. What is missing is a unifying framework for the many and various thoughts on what it means to be creative. What's missing is a taxonomy of creative design. Here's my effort. Measured against axes of form and content, and on a spectrum ranging from perfect imitation to complete originality, creative work falls within one of five categories: imitation, variation, combination, transformation, and genesis, or original creation. Boundaries between the categories are blurry, and within each category, creative work may lean towards novelty and content on the x-axis, or novelty in form on the y-axis, or novelty in both, straight up the diagonal. Let's start with imitation. A painter who perfectly imitates the Mona Lisa has created nothing new save the canvas, yet we admire her creative skill. This imitation is the starting point for creation. It's the foundation. Picasso, we remember, painted realism before he defined his own style. The Baroque music masters learned by transcribing the masters that came before them. Bach became Bach by physically writing down the organ and chamber works of Buxtehude, a composer who came before him. Similarly, the great Renaissance playwrights, Marlowe, Shakespeare, and the poets, Milton, they spent their grade school years copying, translating, and imitating the classical greats, Virgil, Ovid, and more. It's the apprentice model, and it served humankind for millennia. The works of imitation rarely hold high places in the domain, but they're natural precedents to more complex creative works. In this way, imitation is a potent tool for instruction. Memorizing verse in English classes is the first step to writing in the style of those poets and authors. And as a side, I know Jamie Cassap from Google yesterday was tweeted as having called for an end to memorization, but I think that if we talked through it, we'd agree on separate points. The internet obviates the need for memorizing discrete facts, but memorization remains valuable as a means for processing content or style for the purpose of creative work. If imitation is the foundation for creativity, then variation enables creative workers to begin developing their own creative styles. In a number of sophomore English classes, after reading The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I often ask students to rewrite the novel's opening paragraph, which describes the main character, Mr. Utterson, but ask them to rewrite it using precisely the same grammatical construction as Stevenson, but varying the vocabulary and subject matter to match members of their families. In this way, Stevenson's opening sentence, Mr. Utterson the lawyer, this is my best Victorian voice, Mr. Utterson the lawyer was a man of rugged countenance that was never lighted by a smile, cold, scanty, and embarrassed in discourse, backward in sentiment, lean, long, dusty, dreary, and yet somehow lovable. In one student's version becomes, John the student was a boy of youthful countenance that was rarely shadowed by a frown. Witty, intelligent, and loud in discourse, earnest in sentiment, tall, tough, wiry, winsome, and yet somehow childlike. The students identify grammatical structures, literary devices, imagery, and patterns in content, but they experiment with variations to create their own meaning. The results are not always perfect, but through variation they take steps towards increasingly complex work, original work. I think much of the generative work, procedural work in math classes is a remarkably similar creative work of variation. The proofs, the factoring of complex polynomials, the transformation of trigonometric functions, they're taking the grammar of theorems and identities and adapting and tweaking them to explain new problems. Combination moves further from imitation by taking multiple existing works and mashing them together. Any fan of popular music from the last 10 or 15 years will know the mashup has become a genre all its own, literally overlaying two pieces of music to create something new. In these works, there's sometimes technically no original content, and yet the combination and arrangement of the two pieces creates novelty and form. You might be familiar with DJ Danger Mouse's mashup of the lyrics from Jay-Z's Black Album with remixed samples of the music from the Beatles' White Album. The finished work was distributed online for free as the Gray Album, yes. Opportunities in the classroom for creativity through combination are many, and I'm most excited about how teachers will begin to explore Seth Priebosch's conversation about game ecosystems on a more granular level. His proposed revision of schools, I think, is the result of a combination of two ideas, game design and schools, to create a new one. With transformation, creative workers start with an existing work and transform it into another material or medium. Transformation of modes, such as the Nutcracker and the RSA animation of Robinson's speech, are sure examples of this work. But so is the social graph of Othello. Students transform verbal encounters into a visual representation of the relationships within them. Similarly, when history students describe transforming their textbook reading into a timeline or a chronology that separates political, social, and economic and other forces, they open up an opportunity for new kinds of analysis. They're stimulated to create new understanding from existing information. I remember proctoring a history exam years ago, and as part of the exam, students had to script a conversation between historical figures on a given topic. Let's say it was between Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois, and Barack Obama across generations about the shape of the civil rights movement. An assignment like this incorporates both combination of discrete perspectives and transformation of knowledge from one format, the essay, to another, dialogue. And I loved it, so I stole the idea for part of my own English classes the following year. Or maybe, instead of saying I stole it, I should say I created a variation of it, or I combined it with elements of my English class. Either way, this does well to introduce the most elusive of categories, which is original creation. This is how most people see, in the world, see creativity, I think. Original creation they see as the touch of the muse that some people suspect belongs only to artists or to creative geniuses. And yet, as Jane McGonigal mentioned last year at South by Southwest Interactive, Jane McGonigal, by the way, who will be speaking later today at this conference, she said, if I ask everyone in this room to tell a story about a cat, every story would be entirely different and entirely original, both in what it is made of, the content, and how you tell it, the form. We're all quite capable of original creation. Original creation, many people have also argued, may only be the cumulative effects of other forms of creative work, but with a result so novel that the influence of previous works is unrecognizable. Who knows whether or not this is so? I'm not going to go there. The iPhone, though, seemed a work of original creation, and yet it may simply be the result of combining cell phones, computers, and touchscreens. Whether definitively original or no, creative work in this category looks or sounds like nothing we've ever heard before. When Beethoven added a chorus at the end of the Ninth Symphony, he shaped a symphony in a way that no one had heard. When Eiffel planned his tower in Paris, he envisioned structures in an entirely new way. Nevertheless, both of these could be seen as products of other creative techniques. In schools, we might ask students to create wholly original work, but if we do so, I think we do best to greatly narrow their focus by thinking in earlier stages. More on this in a moment when we talk about theory and practice. But first, it's important to add that now in the digital age, there's an emerging form of creativity that is not new, but is growing in relevance and importance, and that is curation, selection. Yesterday, there were at least two topics focused on this alone. With content flooding the digital waterways, sorry, I'm going to move fast, we're limited on time. Choosing what we pay attention to and what we share is increasingly important and prevalent in the creative process. Even Nietzsche, the great negator, was in on it. He said, all great artists and thinkers are great workers, indefatigable not only in inventing, but also in rejecting, sifting, ordering. This is curation. But what about this guy? People think that focus means saying yes to the thing you've got to focus on, but that's not all. But that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the 100 other good ideas that there are. This is curation, choosing from many objects, from many options. When we think of curation, we generally think of something like museum gallery curation, but for institutions, this also means hiring, curriculum planning, sifting through resumes. This is a selection process. The makeup of our faculty, the goals of our curricula, this is creative work through selection. And at the personal level, curation describes actions as simple as managing our Facebook walls. We select pictures or links to share with friends. We choose from the great flood of information that we will post or repost, that we will tweet or retweet. It's a creative act, and it's also at the core of much of our academic work. Choosing evidence for an essay, selecting which theorem to apply to a math problem. As much as any other, and perhaps even more, it requires critical thinking to evaluate relevancy and saliency. And so, not to be ignored, we place curation at the origin of the graph, measuring novelty in form and content. Broadly, these two ways about thinking about creativity aim to organize and represent creativity in a way that we can apply meaningfully to our classrooms. I apologize if I'm going so fast. One identifies places where we can be creative. The other offers tools to practice being creative, and if we like, to analyze creative work. But equally as important, we might think about how this reflects on us as practitioners. How might we imitate, vary, or combine the work of our colleagues? How might we mentally reimagine their work in our classrooms or offices? Fundamentally, teaching is, after all, a daily creative act. Skipping ahead. And so, to execute this well, what follows are four quick guidelines for how to put this theory into practice, how to do this well. First, content is king. In order for creative work to be useful in any way, it must revolve around the content or learning skills, content or skills the work is designed to engage. In other words, creative design in schools is most helpful when the creative work serves to most effectively demonstrate or illuminate the content or meaning of a particular topic. Similarly, the skills we want our students to learn, or the knowledge that we hope they will gain, must be at the core of our creative work. Without this foundation, we foster sensation without sense. We ask for action without purpose. I often think about this in the context of technology in the classroom, which really is an opportunity for creative pedagogy. But when we hear people ask, how can we use technology in the classroom, I think we're fundamentally asking the wrong question. To best use technology in the classroom, the question we should ask is, how can technology enhance what we do in the classroom? This is a useful question in which the teaching is the priority. The technology opens up myriad opportunities, but it ought to be invisible. If we showcase technology in our classrooms, we're missing the point. We ought to showcase the learning that the technology enables. Another and slightly more controversial example of the primacy of content, in the context of modes of learning, the conventional wisdom for years has been that since students have different learning profiles, we must adjust and customize our teaching to suit their learning style. Empirical research in the past 5 years, however, has begun to disprove this hypothesis, or at least show that hypothesis has not been proven. Instead, it argues, the mode of learning that best demonstrates the content is, recent research has shown, more important than the preferred mode of learning of the student. If molecular structures, for example, are best demonstrated through tactile models of molecules that a student can hold and move around, then all kinds of learners, visual, auditory, tactile, kinesthetic, they will all better understand molecular structure if it is presented to them in a tactile way. The content of the class should drive the mode in which it's presented. This is the rising tide that lifts all boats. Our challenge as teachers, then, remains to adjust our teaching to suit the content. Second, restriction promotes innovation. Creativity functions best when it is given requirements. Architects love the challenge of the program. Improv comedians always work within structures. Writers often work off prompts from editors. When designing assignments for our students, the more clearly defined the area for creative work is, the more students will know where to focus their energy, and the better the results will be. When younger students are locked into Robert Louis Stevenson's grammar, for example, students focus more carefully on the precision of their word choice. How strictly we set these boundaries changes over time, and the room to create widens as they grow. In my experience as a teacher so far, I found that when asking for original content from students from all grade levels, it is best to give them a narrow framework within which they can generate their original work, for their efforts are more focused when they have clearly defined conditions for exploration. Igor Stravinsky, the composer, may have said it best when he said, "My freedom will be so much the greater and more meaningful the more narrowly I limit my field of action and the more I surround myself with obstacles. Whatever diminishes constraint diminishes strength. The more constraints one imposes, the more one frees oneself of the chains that shackle the spirit." The kind of game design that we've been seeing at this conference is a perfect example. The whole concept of game design is that students experiment and explore within carefully crafted parameters. And the way students engage and respond to the restrictions or rules of the games or the rules of game creation are what prompt student thinking. And within these confines, students generate marvelous things. Third, when creating successfully, chance favors the connected mind. In his book, Where Good Ideas Come From, Stephen Johnson explores the history of breakthrough ideas and where they've come from. Chance favors the connected mind is his renewal of Louis Pasteur's famous statement, chance favors the prepared mind. And the evolution of those phrases alone, from prepared to connected, seems to mark well the changes in time from Pasteur to the present. The topic of connectivity and networks is a subject in itself, but practically a good starter reference for anyone here might be the recent article in The New Yorker by Jonah Lehrer entitled Groupthink. In it, Lehrer reports about what makes the most successful teams so that new ideas continue to circulate. How else might we keep connected to information as well as people? Read a lot. Even yesterday, LeVar Burton said, "Being open to stimuli is the root of creativity." It's not as tweet-worthy as some of the other things that he said, but it was a really good statement. That's what reading is. It's being connected. How else? Go places, talk to lots of people. And if you're administrators, somebody suggested this to me the other day, if you're administrators and you want to build a creative, innovative faculty, consider only hiring faculty with hobbies. These are the people who are more likely to mix and match, to connect, to bring things together, to combine and transform things in their worlds. And lastly, simplicity marks the best creative work. When we speak of simplicity here, we speak of simplicity on the other side of complexity, the kind of clarity that comes from understanding something completely and recognizing the simple solution that achieves the core essence of the challenge. It's just the right angle of the chair. It's just the right note of music. It's just the right word or just the right equation at the right time, made up of just the right parts. It is as much style as substance, and this sentiment is echoed in arts and business alike. From the architect and designer Mies van der Rohe, an interesting plainness is the most difficult and precious thing to achieve. To the musician Charles Mingus, making the simple complicated is commonplace. Making the complicated simple, that's creativity. Two, of course, Apple computers, who packaged their early machines with Leonardo da Vinci's phrase, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. And so stepping back and looking broadly at the screen, you might glean that it's organized into two groups of suggestions by column. The left column reflects the what of creativity. It's what we need for meaningful creativity. It sets the terms for work that is both divergent and convergent. From top to bottom, work must be content-centric, purpose-centric, and the space for creativity must be narrowly defined. And the right column reflects the how of creativity. It's how we move towards excellent creative work. It offers a benchmark and a catalyst. From bottom to top, excellent creative work increasingly emerges from the most connected networks or connected people, and it is, at its best, simple. As we absorb and connect to more and more people and information, we must constantly remind ourselves to simplify, to reduce, to pare down. And this brings us to the great bugaboo, assessing creativity. That's a bugaboo, by the way. It's that constant refrain, how can you grade creative writing? But I think this is not the bugaboo that we think it is. If our purpose is clear and our guidelines narrow, then we have a definitive rubric for measuring creative work. We have clear instructions for assessment because we are looking for specific outcomes. What does this look like? In the Jekyll and Hyde assignment, our goal was to imitate Stevenson's grammar, his imagery, and the poetry of his language. And so I might look at student alliteration or syllabic content. I can hone in on specific passages. I can offer specific feedback and assess them objectively and know that I'm developing not only my students' literary analytical skills, but also their ability to create novel work. Similarly, recall the assignment in which the student composes a conversation between Booker T. Washington, W.B. Du Bois, and Barack Obama about the evolution of the civil rights movement. How might this be assessed? If it's a history project, we might stress content over form and evaluate how well are the varying perspectives represented. Does the writing meaningfully incorporate Du Bois's talented 10th or Washington's Tuskegee machine? Does it address the reality or unreality of a post-racial America? These are measurable. If it's an English assignment, we might weigh form slightly more over content. Are the voices authentic? Can we detect diction from the 20th century in Washington and Du Bois's words? Can we detect diction from the 21st century in Obama's? In both cases, we have specific guidelines and or content knowledge that we're looking for. With these targets, assessment isn't a mystery. In many ways, it becomes as straightforward as grading a test, as measuring an outcome. And this language, the language of outcomes, brings us full circle back to the definition of innovation, of novelty and value, of novelty and measured outcomes, creativity and critical thinking. Developing innovative students, promoting innovative work, means nurturing and evaluating these complementary opposites. Which brings us at last, almost to the end. And so to review, we began with a short argument asserting the relationship between and the importance of critical thinking and creativity. We clarified a few definitions and distinctions so that we know what it is we're talking about. We discussed two new theories that aim to clarify the subject, the three regions of creativity, which is where creativity happens, the taxonomy of creative design, which is how to teach creativity. We looked at some notes on these theories in practice, how to teach creativity well, and how to assess creativity. And we're here at the closing thoughts. I have one final, but I think equally important note about creativity, but one that feels increasingly difficult to argue in academic and political settings. And that is that creativity is essential to our happiness, to our fulfillment as a species. Theorist on creativity, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, has simply stated, most of the things that are interesting, important, and human are the results of creativity. And this translates not only into the consumption of creative works, but also and especially into the participation in creative work. He says, when we are involved in creativity, we feel that we are living more fully than during the rest of life. 150 years earlier, Ralph Waldo Emerson made a similar argument. He said, expression is all we want, not knowledge, but vent. We know enough, but have not leaves and lungs enough for a healthy perspiration and growth. Today, if for no other reason than that it feels good, it's also important that we treasure the opportunity to create in our schools and in our daily lives. It helps us understand and express who we are. When we write, draw, experiment, compose, and yes, imitate, vary, combine, transform, and originate, we bring something into existence that didn't exist before. And it carries a small abstract piece of ourselves with it. It's a kind of birth. We release thought and feeling into our creative work. And while it may not always be polished, it will exist in a shape or form that another person may intellectually or aesthetically understand or play with, and then pass along through the long chain of human existence. Thanks. Thank you.